Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the theatre at Australia's Parliament House. We meet here today, of course, where people have met for thousands of years. So before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples, who are the traditional custodians of the Canberra area, and pay respect to their elders, past and present. Before we delve into matters historical today, can I do something very modern and just ask you to make sure your mobile phones are turned to silent or switched off? That'd be very useful. Something else that's very modern is that we're live streaming this today, which apparently means people out there can see what's going on in here on the internet. So welcome. Today's lecturer in the Senate Occasional Lecture Series is Aaron Pegram, a senior historian in the military history section at the Australian War Memorial. Aaron has published extensively on the First World War, is a historical guide for the War Memorial's battlefield tours to the Western Front, and was recently appointed historian for the First World War Centenary Projects. We're fortunate that Aaron will be bringing all of that experience to bear today on his topic, Politicians at War, the Experiences of Australian Senators and Members in the First World War. So I'd invite you to join me in welcoming Aaron to the microphone.
Sometime around noon on the 25th of April 1915, a 35-year-old sergeant of the Australian 1st Battalion lay mortally wounded in thick scrub above the beach that would later become known as Anzac Cove. Having come ashore with the second wave attack earlier that morning, men of the 1st Battalion were rushed inland to a position on Pine Ridge to help reinforce the tenuous foothold troops of the 3rd Brigade were holding in the face of growing Turkish resistance. Stretcher bearers came to carry the wounded man back down the gully, but he refused. "There's plenty worse out there than me," he said, in what was the last time he was ever seen alive. Sergeant Ted Larkin was one of 8,100 Australian and New Zealand troops killed and wounded at Anzac within the first week of fighting. His body was recovered during the informal truce with Turkish troops in the following weeks, but the whereabouts of his final burial place remains unknown. As such, he is commemorated on the Lone Pine Memorial, alongside 4,934 Australian and New Zealand soldiers killed on Gallipoli who have no known grave. As a soldier, Larkin appears no different from the 33,000 men who served in the Australian Imperial Force during the First World War. But as a civilian, he was among a number of state and federal politicians who saw active service with the AIF during the First World War. According to figures by the Commonwealth Parliamentary Library, 119 Australian MPs saw active service in the First World War. 72 were members of the House of Representatives, 44 were senators, and 3 served in both chambers. Among them were 9 federal MPs who fought while in office and an estimated 20 state MPs who saw active service abroad during their time in office. Not only were these men who debated, decided, and wrote legislative for a young Australian nation, but they, like many young Australians, were personally affected by the war and the nation's involvement in it. As the Labor member for Willoughby in the New South Wales, as well as the NRL's first full-time secretary, Ted Larkin was among 10,000 men who enlisted at Victoria Barracks in Sydney within a fortnight of Britain's declaration of war with Germany in August 1914. To a crowd outside the recruiting depot, Larkin announced that this was, and I quote, "a critical time for our empire, and I deem it the duty of those holding public positions to point the way." The First World War cast an exceptionally long shadow over Australian history. From a wartime population of 4.5 million people, the cost of participating in the war was exceptionally high. Within 4 short years, the AIF sustained 215,000 casualties, of which 60,000 died on active service, while countless others and their families lived with the war's psychological consequences in the decades afterwards. Virtually every household and community in Australia was affected by the fighting, which included debates over the issue of conscription, which divided Australia along social, sectarian, and political lines. My paper this afternoon will demonstrate that the war also had a deep and lasting impact on Australia's political community, not just in the form of the political issues that affected the nation during the war, but on a more private level, impacting on serving politicians in both state and federal politics whose sense of loyalty, duty and patriotism to the broader British Empire led them to become active participants in the fighting. The First World War is often seen today as a costly and futile slaughter of no real gain or outcome. But in 1914, Australians like Ted Larkin were deeply and personally committed to Australia's military, commitment to the conflict. This was mainly due to the fact that Australia was a dominion of the British Empire and shared exceptionally close ties with Britain when war began. The six self-governing British colonies had federated just 13 years before the outbreak of war. 20% of the population residing in Australia had been born in Britain, and on the international level, Britain still managed Australia's diplomatic relations with the rest of the world. These strong ties to what Australians referred to as the mother country meant that there were few dissenting voices in Australia in August 1914, when German troops invaded neutral Belgium, putting an invasion force within 100 kilometres of the English Channel ports. When Britain declared war on the 4th of August 1914, Australia was automatically at war, along with the rest of the British dominions. This may seem absurd to modern Australians, but the government at the time was willing to accept Britain's decision without question, believing that defending the rights of small countries like Belgium and containing German expansionism in Europe were core interests for Australia. News that Britain was at war with Germany came in the midst of a federal election campaign, where it received unanimous support from both sides of politics. One of the earliest overtures took place at Horsham in Victoria, weeks before war was declared, when the incumbent Prime Minister Joseph Cook announced that if war broke out in Europe, all Australia's resources would be committed for the preservation of the British Empire. His opponent, the leader of the Australian Labor Party, Andrew Fisher, echoed the sentiment at Colac, where he famously declared that Australia would stand beside our own to help and defend Britain to our last man and our last shilling. Some recruiting posters there echoing the sentiments of the time. Recruiting began for the Australian Imperial Force on the 11th of August in order to fulfil the government's pledge to send Britain a military force of 20,000 troops in the form of an infantry division and a light horse brigade. But by the end of the year, 50,000 men had already enlisted and volunteered for active service abroad. Outside Victoria Barracks in Sydney, Ted Larkin urged all in public office to lead by example and volunteer for active service. But the reality was that very few members in state and federal parliament at the time would have met the strict eligibility requirements. At the start of the war, the AIF required applicants to be between the ages of 18 and 35, a height of 5'6" and a chest measurement of 34 inches. Since the average age of federal MPs at the time was 43, most were either too old or too unfit to serve. Recruiting standards lowered after Gallipoli, as mounting casualty figures and falling enlistment numbers resulted in a greater need to fill reinforcement quotas. So it was not until later in the war that most MPs could follow Ted Larkin's example. In January 1916, at the age of 51, the federal member for Bendigo, Alfred Hampson, fronted the recruiting depot at Melbourne's Town Hall, where he passed the medical test but was turned away because of his age. Undeterred, Hampson tried a second time after losing his seat to Billy Hughes in the 1917 federal election. After leaving Parliament and lying about his age, Hampson was eventually accepted into the AIF and served on the Western Front in the final months of the war, serving with the 2nd Light Railway Operating Company. Some MPs had political and religious reasons that prevented them from serving in the AIF, and certainly some felt a moral obligation to their constituencies to remain in Australia. During the 1914 federal election, the senior member for the federal Labor opposition, Billy Hughes, suggested suspending the election during the international crisis in support of a government of national unity. Hughes's proposal meant elected members would return unopposed, but the idea was considered unworkable and quickly forgotten. Federal MPs who felt duty-bound to enlist took a leave of absence and generally became from parties that occupied safe seats, while those in marginal seats were more inclined to enlist after the 1917 federal election. William Fleming, the federal member for Robertson, enlisted as a private in 1916 following news that his old Labor opponent, William Johnson, had been killed at Pozieres. Fleming was still in camp where his Conservative seat was contested by Labor candidate Eva Seary, one of the first women endorsed by a major party to contest the Australian Parliament, who questioned the duration of his training and accused him, and I quote, playing at soldiers. An ardent patriot who opposed conscription Fleming's personal decision to enlist helped Hughes and his national colleagues brand themselves as the Win the War Party, conveying the message that they alone could lead Australia to victory for the imperial cause. Fleming successfully retained his seat and sailed for England 5 months later as a driver with the Australian Army Service Corps. Promoted to sergeant, he was gassed at Peronne in France in September 1918 and returned to Australia after the armistice. Some politicians simply could not face the shame of not going to the war. One was James O'Loughlin, the only sitting senator to serve overseas, who enlisted in 1915 and declared to the Defence Minister George Pearce, and I quote, "If you can't put me in the firing line, put me near to it as you can." Another was Granville Ryrie, a distinguished Boer War veteran and national member for North Sydney, who wrote to his wife on the 4th of August 1914, "I simply couldn't look men in the face again, especially if some of my political opponents whom I've accused of disloyalty, if I didn't offer to go. I simply cannot hold back." A major in the part-time militia and commander of the 3rd Light Horse Regiment, Ryrie typified a number of militia officers who held political positions in the years after Federation. With substantial command and leadership experience backed by years of overseas service, men like Ryrie were fundamental in raising, training, and commanding the newly formed AIF before it sailed for the Great War. Promoted to Brigadier General, Ryrie was given command of the 2nd Light Horse Brigade, which defended the Suez Canal in Egypt against Ottoman incursions, then fought dismounted at Gallipoli, where his men held the southernmost defences at Anzac. Wounded twice on Gallipoli, Ryrie later led his men across the Sinai Desert and took part in the long advance across Palestine and into Jordan. He was awarded the Order of the Nile, mentioned in dispatches no less than 5 times, and commanded the Anzac Mounted Division before returning home to his electorate in 1919. Ryrie had a long and distinguished military career that would have certainly helped his political aspirations in the years after the war. But there was at least one New South Wales politician who had risen through the ranks of the pre-war militia and whose skills and command and leadership experience ended much more than his time in politics. The Liberal member for Armidale, George Braund, commanded the 13th Infantry Regiment on the eve of the First World War, and on the formation of the AIF in August 1914, was appointed commander of the 2nd Battalion. Braund led his men ashore in Gallipoli on the morning of April 25th, 1915, and for 2 days held an isolated position atop of Walker's Ridge in the face of growing Turkish resistance. Early on the morning of 4th of May, Braund set off to brigade headquarters via a shortcut through the scrub. Slightly deaf, he failed to hear a challenge from an Australian sentry who mistook him for a Turk and killed him. There's a photograph there of Ted Larkin and George Braund and another member of Parliament, the New South Wales Legislative Assembly in Egypt. So it's quite an interesting photograph because two of the three men there, not only were they politicians, but they were killed in the fighting on Gallipoli. Larkin, Fleming, O'Loughlin, and Ryrie were all equated war service with an unwavering loyalty to the British Empire. But in South Australia, Australia's entry to the war affected the careers of a number of political figures in a very different way. Germans were the largest non-British group of Europeans in Australia at the time, and reflecting the large population of German migrants that settled in South Australia in the 19th century, there were at least seven South Australian MPs of identifiably German descent in Parliament when Britain went to war with their homeland. All seven members, 5 Liberal and 2 Labor, came under intense public scrutiny at a time when Germans and all things German were openly subjected to hostility. As rumours of atrocity stories from the fighting in northern France and Belgium filtered home, locals directed their anger at some of the state's most respected German citizens. Among them was the Attorney General and Industry Minister, Hermann Homburg, whose offices in Adelaide were raided after the war was declared by soldiers with rifles and fixed bayonets. Homburg resigned in January 1915 to avoid embarrassing the government in the forthcoming election, writing of a campaign, and I quote, "of lies and calumnies against me because I am not of British heritage." The German MPs were considered something of an electoral handicap when the state government lost the election, and mistrust intensified the following year when it was clear that voters in German districts had contributed to South Australia's rejection of the conscription referendum in October 1916. The war gravely affected the political careers of these German MPs holding office in South Australia, with just 1 of the 7 remaining in office in November 1918. After Gallipoli, the AIF returned to Egypt, where it effectively doubled in size in preparation for the fighting on the Western Front. As soon as the AIF returned in France in mid-1916, the main challenge facing Australians was matching casualties with a steady stream of willing volunteers. 8 months of fighting on Gallipoli had cost the AIF 26,000 casualties, which the AIF lost in less than 8 weeks in France in costly actions at Fromelles, Pozières and Mouquet Farm. In Australia, state-based recruiting committees increased their efforts in urging young men to enlist in the Australian Imperial Force. And certainly local members used public meetings and gathering to urge the men in their electorate to volunteer. Some led by example, such as Ambrose Carmichael, the Labor Minister of Leichhardt and Minister for Public Instruction in New South Wales Parliament, who signed on as soon as the extended age requirements permitted him to do so. In November 1915, Carmichael announced that he would personally raise 1,000 reserve recruits from rifle clubs in New South Wales. Enlisting as a private at the age of 44, Carmichael and his willing volunteers entered Broadmeadow Camp in Newcastle, New South Wales, where they formed the basis of the newly raised 36th Battalion, a unit that colloquially became referred to as Carmichael's 1,000. Carmichael was eventually commissioned as a lieutenant and embarked with the battalion on the training camps of England before proceeding to the Western Front in November 1916. And there he became a commander known for his exceptional command of brimstone and fire. As part of the 3rd Division, the 36th Battalion spent the following weeks in the relatively quiet Houpline sector near the town of Armentières, where it carried out a regime of patrolling and trench raiding throughout the ensuing winter. In January 1917, Carmichael was seriously wounded in the face and hands when a German raiding party attacked the Australian positions and was evacuated to England for treatment and recovery. For conspicuous gallantry in organising his platoon under heavy German bombardment, and I quote, "for setting a splendid example of courage and determinism," Ambrose Carmichael was awarded the Military Cross. Carmichael missed out on the fighting at Messines, but he was promoted to captain and rejoined his unit in Belgium at the time to participate in the 3rd Battle of Ypres. He was wounded a second time at Brutsinda on the 4th of October, receiving gunshot wounds to his arms and legs, which necessitated his evacuation to England and repatriation to Australia in January 1918. Carmichael was a strong advocate of conscription, but his return to Australia in the wake of the defeat of the second conscription referendum led him to appeal for another, and I quote, "great sustained recruiting campaign," as voluntary enlistments for the AIF plummeted to an all-time low. He was not expelled from the Labor Party after the split over conscription, but he gradually drifted away from the party as he invested all his energy in stimulating voluntary recruiting. In February 1918, Carmichael became the chairman of the New South Wales Recruiting Committee, raising yet another Carmichael's 1,000 and returning to France with a reinforcement group for the 33rd Battalion in September 1918. He arrived just several weeks before the armistice was signed and did not see any further fighting. Carmichael returned to Australia and state politics, where he was revered as something of an overage and mercurial war hero. But his energy and personal sense of conviction in believing for the cause for which he had fought was shared by at least one other politician who had enlisted in the later stages of the war. Bartholomew Stubbs, a Labor member for Subiaco in the West Australian Legislative Assembly, enlisted as soon as the eligibility requirements permitted, signing on in Perth at the age of 43 in January 1916. As a member of the West Australian Recruiting Committee, Stubbs had publicly voiced his beliefs about the justice in the Allied cause and had spoken at a number of recruiting platforms in the Subiaco area, but believed leading by example was the best course of action. To reporters of the Daily News, Stubbs urged middle-aged men without children or other ties or whose children have grown up to volunteer before the young married men. This is an image of Stubbs' attestation form held by the National Archives of Australia. And it's interesting for a number of reasons, because for the vast majority of men who served in the AIF, there's a very large percentage of them are simply labourer or clerk. But Stubbs has the distinction of actually having Member of Parliament as his calling on his attestation paper. It also says that he was convicted of a civil offence in West Australia, which I haven't actually looked up yet. So that's something for the office when I return. After a brief period of training at Black Boy Hill, east of Perth, and a stint at the Royal Military Academy at Duntroon, Stubbs was commissioned as a second lieutenant and embarked for the Western Front with a reinforcement for the 51st Battalion. In Flanders in early August, he sent a cablegram confirming that he would run again as a Labor candidate in the upcoming West Australian state election. And on the 12th of September, he retained his Subiaco seat unopposed. 2 weeks later, Stubbs was shot in the chest and killed during the RAF's highly successful attack at Polygon Wood near the Belgian town of Ypres. According to one account written 18 years after the war, the loss of such a popular commander resulted in soldiers of his platoon seeking battlefield vengeance on a group of surrendering German soldiers whose pleas for mercy were swiftly ignored. Stubbs was given a hasty battlefield burial by his men, but the location of the temporary grave marker was subsequently lost in later fighting. Stubbs therefore has no known grave and is today commemorated on the Menin Gate in Memorial in Ypres amid the names of 6,100 Australians who remain missing from the fighting in Belgium. Commenting on the makeup of Australian politics in the decades after the war, Chris Coulthard-Clark writes that the First World War was something of a catalyst for the military influx into state and federal politics. The diversity of issues such as conscription, inflation, wage freezing and export embargoes had the effect of hardening political views in Australian society and caused a number of returned servicemen to enter politics before the armistice. Throughout the 1920s, men who had risen through the ranks of the AIF occupied command positions were highly decorated during the war were naturally driven to a career in politics. Victoria Cross recipients Lieutenant Arthur Blackburn and Private William Curry both entered state politics on their return to Australia, as did General Sir William Glasgow, Major General Sir Neville House, who had won a Victoria Cross during the Boer War, Sir John Jellybrand, Brigadier General Harold Pompey Elliott, and Colonel Edmund Drake Brockman. Some rose to prominence after their war service. Wilfred Kent Hughes, Cabinet Secretary and Government Whip in the Victorian Legislative Assembly in the late 1920s, had served with the 3rd Light Horse Regiment on Gallipoli, where he was wounded in the charge at the neck in August 1915. Serving again during the Second World War, he was captured by the Japanese at Singapore in February 1942 and spent 3 years imprisoned at Changi, Formosa and Manchuria. Thomas White, the Minister for Trade and Customs in the First Lines Ministry, had been a pilot in the Australian Flying Corps. Brought down over Mesopotamia in 1915, White spent 3 years a prisoner of war of the Turks and was the only Australian officer to escape Turkish captivity. Another was Jim Fairbairn, the Minister for Civil Aviation in the Second Menzies Ministry, who had served as a pilot in the Royal Flying Corps in the Great War. Fairbairn was brought down near Cambrai in February 1917 when his aircraft was set upon by a yasser of German scouts. With his arm and aircraft shredded by machine gun fire and his face badly burnt, Fairbairn crash landed on the other side of No Man's Land and spent the following 12 months in a prisoner of war camp in Germany. At least one third of senators and members in federal politics in the late 1940s were First World War veterans, but it's very important to recognise that the conflict also shaped the lives of some of Australia's first female politicians. Although Australian women had the right to vote and be nominated for federal election in 1903, and some had the right to stand in the Legislative Assembly by 1914, it was not until after the First World War that the first female members of Parliament were elected. A strong advocate for the suffrage movement and women's rights and welfare, Edith Cowan was the first woman elected to an Australian Parliament after her victory in West Australia in 1920. During the war years, Cowan had worked for a number of patriotic and humanitarian aid organisations, which included the Australian Red Cross Society, for which she helped with fundraising and started up the Welcome Home for Returned Soldiers. For this, Cowan was awarded an OBE after the war, but during it, she was an ardent pro-conscription campaigner and an active member of the Perth Recruiting Committee. Red Cross work played a crucial role in involving women in the war effort and in public life, but the war also had a profound effect on women like Ivy Webber, the first woman elected in the general election in Victoria, whose war years were spent maintaining family and home. Long before she entered politics in the 1930s, Webber received the devastating news that her husband, Lieutenant Thomas Mitchell of the 59th Battalion, had been killed in action near Bapaume. Just like any other community in Australia at the time, the First World War had a very significant impact on the personal and private lives of a number of state and federal politicians whose sense of patriotism, duty and loyalty to the Empire led them to become active participants in the First World War. Some led by example, not wanting to hide behind the excuse of public position to shirk their duty and do what many political figures were expecting of other men, while others, with extensive experience in raising, training and commanding soldiers, helped raise a voluntary army that served with distinction on Gallipoli, in Sino-Palestine and on the Western Front. Perhaps one of the reasons why their story remains little known in Australia is the fact that no one memorial recognises the service and sacrifice made by both state and federal MPs during the First World War. The three serving MPs who died in the war are commemorated on the bronze cloisters of the Roll of Honour in the Australian War Memorial, alongside 102,000 other men, Australian men and women who died on active service since before the Boer War. But these men appear without distinction, rank or profession that points to the very unique community to which they belonged. One of the very few memorials is a small tablet to Ted Larkin and George Braun in the New South Wales Parliamentary Chamber, which was unveiled in November 1915 and is still there today. The inscription thereon reminds us that the First World War had a long-lasting and very significant impact on the lives of all Australians, which included those in public office. On it, it says, "In times of peace, they readily asserted the rights of citizenship. In the time of war, they fiercely protected it." Thank you.
Thanks so much, Aaron. We do have some roving microphones available if people do want to address any questions to Aaron on his contribution today. I think we have a volunteer here, Tim.
My name is Graham O'Loughlin. My grandfather is the senator that you referred to from South Australia.
Welcome.
You somehow inferred, I think, that he was shamed into it, which I think maybe I read that, inferred that wrongly, but it sounded like that. You didn't mention that he was 62 at the time, which makes it a bit difficult for him to be embarrassed about not going.
Yeah.
He did prevail upon the Minister of Defence to allow him to go, and he was eventually put in command of a troop ship, appointed a lieutenant colonel, and did two trips to Egypt at the age of 62 and was a serving senator.
Yeah. Oh, look, by no means that inference that he was somehow shamed is not correct. No, I think his remarks to the Defence Minister really point to the fact that he, among many politicians, felt their patriotic duty. And I believe that he also had a very distinguished career in the militia beforehand, which may have actually shaped his views, that if there was to be of service, he was certainly wanting to go, irrespective of his age.
That is quite true. He was an enthusiastic volunteer in the military forces in South Australia, both before and after Federation, and at one point, I think, commanded the Adelaide Rifles.
Right. Wonderful.
Got another down here in front of you, Tim, but I think we've got a... Did we have a question on this side?
I presume that the members of Parliament concerned kept their positions in Parliament while serving, and that they would have received leave of absence. What arrangements were typically made for dealing with constituent affairs and for campaigning in elections?
This is an issue that I really couldn't get my head... I have to admit, I really couldn't get my head around. But the men who did enlist in the AIF, they appear to be from very safe seats. They weren't going to be contested. I haven't found any examples of it in the Australian experience, but certainly in New Zealand, there were two members of Parliament who, from opposite sides of the House, that agreed to pair during the war as to not affect the voting numbers. But in terms of actually dealing with local affairs, I really get the sense that it was done from afar, which, as was the case, and these men did actually take a leave of absence. It's an issue that I'm going to have to take on notice, but it's just something that just works. I get the sense that men who go off to the war, and have occupy safe seats, that they're in a safe position because their constituencies, if they're backing them fully, 100%, no one's going to contest their seats. It's almost seen as being disloyal or unpatriotic. But in terms of how they manage their constituencies, I'm going to have to get back to you on that one.
Did we have some other questions? I can't actually see in the glow right up the back there. Thanks.
Hi. I was just wondering if you've detected any kind of pattern from the people who did enlist who were serving as MPs as to whether or not they were predominantly pro-conscription or predominantly anti-conscription, and whether or not that sort of tells you something about the political climate at the time.
The very interesting thing about conscription, the two conscription referenda, is that it does polarise Australia. But in no way, there's no sort of argument about whether or not Australia should be involved in the war. It's about whether or not men should be going under their own volition. There isn't a pattern. I sort of get the sense that even though there are pro and anti-conscriptionists, that the men who still feel patriotic and certain feel compelled to enlist, they do so for one reason or the other. So there isn't a pattern I can detect, and that's probably because there's a very small percentage of men who enlist as well as serving members. But certainly it's an interesting question that we can probably ponder on.
We had one further down the front here.
You indicated at the start of your address that the age limit on enlistment was 35. Mm. There was a significant number of MPs eventually fought. Were virtually all of them only enlisted after that age was relaxed, or did some of them tell a few lies?
Well, there's a few things. Some evidently did tell a few lies. And if we take the example of William Johnson, who's the former Member of Parliament, Labor MP, who was killed at Pozieres, I think he was in his mid-50s, and he would have enlisted in 1914. So I think there's a few porkies being told there. You also get there is also the increasing age limit as the war progresses. Certainly the men who enlisted in 1914 were among the fittest and strongest that the AIF fielded during the war. But that all changes once we all go to the Western Front, when we have this struggle to try and maintain reinforcement quotas. So the age limit does bump up. And that enables a number of MPs to come to enlist. But there is a sense that, and certainly on the federal level, and this gets back to your question as well, that once the outcome of the 1917 federal election ultimately decides for some people whether they should enlist or not. There's the case of the fellow who's defeated by Hughes, for example. Even though he's tried before, the election in 1917 is certainly something that is a great impetus. So that's another thing. As long as the war continues, the age limit sort of gets bumped up, and more men are sort of being drawn in. There's also the issue of the militiamen who were serving in politics at the time. These men are, they're Boer War veterans. They've commanded their regiments, irrespective of their age. They're fine and capable officers, which at the time the Australian Imperial Force just simply doesn't have. This is an all-volunteer army that's just been formed for the exclusive purpose of serving overseas in the Great War, and it needs commanders. So there are certainly men such as Ryrie, for example. I think he's in his 50s on the eve of the First World War. So there is a number of factors that sort of there are at play there. But certainly the age requirements in 1914, Ted Larkin was among a very few who would have fit them.
Okay, I think that takes up our quota of questions for today. Just before we close here, I'll just let you know the next lecture that we've got is on the 29th of May here in the theatre. 2015 is the 60th anniversary of the Fitzpatrick and Brown affair, which is the only time that the Australian Parliament, the House of Representatives, in fact, has jailed someone using its parliamentary privilege powers. So